This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. In just one American city, it's possible to find somebody who drank champagne on the Champs-Élysées the day the Allies liberated Paris, or a Tuskegee Airman, or somebody who fought the Japanese for Iwo Jima or Saipan, or who survived Stalingrad, the Blitz, or the Battle of the Bulge. Reporter Elizabeth Mulliner has done just that. Ms. Mulliner has written a history of World War II from New Orleans in a book titled War Stories, Remembering World War II. One of the earliest stories in the book features Lawrence Yatsu, who in 1941 was like many other teenage American boys. He went out for his school football team. He raced in the Soapbox Derby. But on December 7, 1941, he heard news that would challenge everything he knew about his country and his place in it.
I was playing in I was up in a pepper tree, and one of my friends came by and says, "Hey, Lawrence, it's the Japanese bombed Hawaii." And I thought, what a crock. And I didn't pay any attention. And then I went and listened to the radio, and sure enough, it happened. And I don't know, I felt horrible.
Lawrence Yatsu was a Nisei, a Japanese-American born in the United States, the child of parents who'd been born in Japan. Ms. Mulliner, what happened to Lawrence Yatsu?
Like 110,000 other people, he was sent to an internment camp. He was, I think, 16 years old at the time.
He later served in the war, didn't he?
He did. In his case, he was sent to Italy as a member of the 442, which was a famous unit made up only of Nisei soldiers, and it was among the most decorated units in the war.
Let's introduce Elizabeth Muller, a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, as well as an author. She joins us from the studios of member station WWNO in New Orleans. And thanks for being with us, Ms. Mulliner.
Thanks for having me.
We'll also hear from a couple of other New Orleanians, Arthur Abramson, who was a Navy fighter pilot in the Pacific. He also joins us. Mr. Abramson, thank you for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Ms. Mulliner, there are 53 stories in this book. We should explain these are not necessarily native New Orleanians. Does the fact that you were able to find at least 53 eyewitnesses to the great events of World War II say something about how vast that event was and how it affected so many people?
Yes, it does to me. It's just testament to what a global upheaval this was. In a lot of the people I wrote about predictably were local boys who went off to war. But many of them were not. They were people who wound up here later, Jewish refugee who got out of Germany just in time, a Holocaust survivor, a Russian soldier who was in the Battle of Stalingrad.
Mr. Abramson, Arthur Abramson, I'd like to turn to you now if we could.
Fine.
You'd always wanted to fly. You used to build model airplanes out of balsa wood?
Yeah, that was my life's ambition, to be a Navy pilot.
It's a long way from building balsa wood airplanes to flying, landing one of those F-6 Hellcats on a carrier at night with nothing resembling the kind of instrumentation we have in airplanes these days.
Landing on a carrier is a very thought-provoking thing right off the bat, and your blood pressure and your heart rate goes off the scale. Now, when the weather begins to get rough and the ship is pitching and rolling as much as 20 to 30 feet, that adds another dimension. And then coming aboard, it was absolute total darkness. And you never knew for sure that the ship was there until you actually hit the deck.
Hit the deck with your wheels, that is.
Yeah, when you make the landing. Carrier landings are sheer terror, interrupted by moments of fright.
Arthur Abramson, I want to get you to tell what I think was just one of the most extraordinary stories I've ever heard, about you and the Japanese pilot who got involved in what certainly seemed like a fight-to-the-death dogfight one afternoon.
Well, I was not more than a couple of hundred feet behind him, and I let go with all six machine guns, 50 calibers, which is a tremendous amount of firefight, and nothing happened. None of the guns would shoot. I was to learn later that I had been hit and then put out the electrical system that operated the guns. And so we were flying along just with me following him, and he made no attempt to come back and engage me. which he easily could have done because the Zero could outmaneuver the F-6F. So I just slid into formation with him the way I would have done with one of my own air fellow pilots, and got so close that our wings, my left wing, was overlapping his right wing, and we were staring at each other like kids looking at somebody they'd never seen before, and I guess that's really what it was about. And then I saw him unbuckling his parachute harness and his safety shoulder straps. He rolled his canopy back, and he turned around till he was facing me, and in traditional Japanese manner, he bent at the waist in a kind of a Japanese goodbye. And I responded in a typical American way by just giving him a wave of my hand. And then at that instant, he peeled off to the left and I peeled off to the right, and I never looked back because I knew he wasn't coming after me.
What an amazing story. Elizabeth Mulliner, to other sections of the book, you found a veteran survivor, in a sense, a veteran of the Battle of Britain, a woman named Ivy Laurent, who I guess, like a lot of Britons of the time, did just a dead, solid, perfect imitation of the most famous Briton of the 20th century. And I'm not forgetting Laurence Olivier.
Never was it known in the history of the British Empire that so much was owed by so many to so few. This was their finest hour. God bless the King, and God bless us all.
Hear, hear. Where did you find Ivy Laurent?
I actually located her through the DBE, the Daughters of the British Empire.
When you talk about surviving the Blitz, she really did survive the Blitz. This was as thousands, hundreds of thousands, really, of Britons who had close calls. She had one of the closer ones. Let's listen to a section of Ivy Laurent's story.
The device that destroyed our neighborhood was not a high-explosive bomb. It was a mine that they would send down in a parachute. And the moment it touched anything, a church steeple or a pylon or a tall tree, it would completely explode. So there was more damage done that way than if it was a high explosive that went down into the ground and exploded. And my brother came. Poor darling, he was only 16. Covered in blood. And he said, "You've got to come home. The house has been hit and I can't handle it." Because our father was away in the Royal Territorial Army.
I want to introduce another guest from New Orleans with another set of memories. Paul Spencer served with General George Patton's Third Army in Europe and also with the Palace of Justice in Nuremberg during the Nuremberg trials. Mr. Spencer, thank you very much for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
You were a guard at the Nuremberg trials.
That's correct. I was one of three officers who were assigned to the courtroom of the 6850th Internal Security Detachment.
Mr. Spencer, I guess I've wanted to ask somebody who can answer this question, all of my life. What was Hermann Göring really like?
Hermann Göring was a Reichsmarschall. He was number two to Hitler. He was used to ordering people around. When we saw him, instead of being 275 pounds, he was down to about 153 pounds. Mm-hmm. He was the only person in the dock who wore a uniform. He was very difficult to communicate with. He was very reluctant to obey anything that you told him. The rest of the prisoners didn't like him one bit and tried to stay away from him as much as they could.
You told him off once, didn't you?
He had it coming to him.
Well, on several different levels, yes. But what got you the opportunity to tell him where to go?
That was one of the days when he just was out of sorts, I guess, and I'm sure I was out of sorts too, but he had just pushed me as far as I wanted to be pushed, so I just told him to go to hell.
You actually had kind of a rapport going with Karl Dönitz. He'd been the admiral of the German Navy, commanded the U-boat fleet, and in fact held power in Germany after Hitler's suicide for a few days.
He got to be really friendly with me, too. I don't know. I guess he sort of had a reason to like me for some reason. I was never unkind to him, and anything he wanted within reason, why I was happy to provide. I didn't get a chance to mention this before anywhere, but he liked girly magazines. So I was able to furnish a few of those for him.
Admiral Dyrnitz liked girly magazines?
Yes, he did.
You got him girly magazines? Do you mind me putting you on the spot?
Yeah, I was able to. I always had this feeling that there still was a wall between us, though, because after all, he was very devoted to Hitler, and he was a Nazi through and through.
Did you feel a palpable sense of evil? Could you read anything in people's faces or bodies? Anything?
You could see that kind of evil in the face of Fritz Sauckel. I would say Arthur Seyss-Inquart. And I guess if I had to pick one who was the worst of the lot, I would say it would be Ernst Kaltenbrunner. He was a huge man. He was number two to Hitler, to Himmler. And, of course, after Himmler killed himself, why, number two got picked to sit in the dock.
Arthur Abramson, let me bring you back in this conversation, too, if I could.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask both you, Mr. Spencer and Arthur Abramson, is the war over for you guys?
Well, it's been over for me for a long time because I've never had any regrets for what I've done. I know I've killed a lot of people, the six airplanes that I shot down accounts for 10 lives, and the uncountable numbers of people bombed and strafed in the whole shooting match. But that was my job. I've come to grips with God over my killings, so I don't look back on it. I'm proud of what I did. I'm thankful that I'm alive, but I have no regrets, and I would go again tomorrow to do the same thing if we ever got thrust into the same kind of a situation.
Mr. Spencer.
Yes, I would agree also that the war has long since left me. It was something that happened then, and there's absolutely no reason for it to play on anyone's mind because it's not happening now.
Elizabeth Mulliner, these are two men who, well, when the call came, they jumped in with honor and valor. What has it been like to get to know people who, so young, had to bring so much bravery and sacrifice into their lives, really before they'd had them?
I'm the furthest thing from a military historian. I'm not the least bit interested in troop movements or in military hardware. But the stories I've heard are just incredible. War is the ultimate story. Talking to these people is like looking history in the face, and it was thrilling to find them.
Well, I can't thank you all for being with us, particularly at these times on this weekend. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott, for having the chance to talk to you.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Scott.
Elizabeth Mulliner is a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune and author of a new book, War Stories, Remembering World War II. It's published by the Louisiana State University Press. Arthur Abramson was a veteran fighter pilot in the Pacific Theater, and Paul Spencer served in Europe, all joining us from the studios of member station WWNO in New Orleans.